TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. This is an archival TUC Radio program on mining in America. Even though mines from iron to copper to gold to minerals, such as lithium mines, can be so huge that they can be seen from space and are destructive to land and water and forests, recent proposed legislation in the U.S. aims to expanding the destruction. It turns out that, ironically, the transition to a green economy with wind turbines, solar arrays, electric vehicles, and battery storage requires an unprecedented increase in mining for lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper, tungsten, aluminum, graphite, and more. Currently, China is producing 80% of the lithium-ion batteries, as well as the least expensive solar panels and electric cars. Recent anti-China politics and U.S. legislation, such as the Inflation Reduction Act, are intended to, quote, grow local manufacturing capacity by investing into domestic energy production. And that means expanding inside the U.S., mining for minerals that the new green technologies require. In 1995, I bought a beat-up RV, put all my radio equipment in it, and took off on a tour of the western states. In the course of 4 years, I visited mines from Arizona to Washington State and from New Mexico to Montana. Here's my report from Montana and a conversation with Larry Tuttle in Portland, Oregon.
Mining in America. The Berkeley Pit of the abandoned Anaconda Copper Mine in Butte, Montana, is so huge that it can be seen from space. The Anaconda Mine is a symbol of mining in America. The size of the calamity is in reverse proportion to public awareness of the unfolding drama and how it came about. Mines produce more toxic waste than any other industry, and they are major polluters of groundwater and streams. Yet, apart from the reporting of dramatic accidents, such as the one in January of 2000 in Romania, they receive little attention. In Romania, the dam of a tailings pond at a gold mine broke, and cyanide-laced wastewater poisoned 50 miles of streams and the drinking water of 5 towns and numerous villages. Gold mines in the U.S. use cyanide as well. In fact, it is a process that was adapted for large-scale use by the U.S. Bureau of Mines. Yet the media are not watching over them. The first cyanide heap leach mine that I saw was the Zortman-Landusky mine in northern Montana. The mine is on the territory of the Grovon and Assiniboine nations. The land and the sacred Spirit Mountain were taken away from them when gold was found there. In the late 1800s, small miners dug tunnels into the mountain. More recently, one of the first cyanide heap leach mines was established there by a Canadian company, Pegasus. Today, Spirit Mountain, once looming high above the ceremonial grounds in the valley, no longer exists. It was ground up into 3/4 minus gravel, the size of road gravel. That gravel was piled into 80-foot-high leach pads, each the size of a football field. Only a 3/8 inch thin plastic sheet prevents the cyanide water solution that is being sprayed onto the heap from percolating down into the groundwater. Gold only exists here in minute quantities. Each 10-ton dump truck of ore has an average of a teaspoon of gold in it. The rock is crushed so the cyanide can wash out the gold specks that then get filtered from the cyanide solution. In contrast to the dramatic accident in Romania, the impact by Zortman-Landusky, that is closed now because Pegasus Gold is bankrupt, is daily, slow, pervasive, and permanent. We drove for almost an hour to get to the southern side of the mine, and found that creeks originating in the mine run bright orange. There still is a picnic ground, but we saw no evidence that anybody visited there recently. Faded signs everywhere warn not to drink or touch the water. The bright orange water is called acid mine drainage, and it is a process that, once set in motion, seems impossible to stop. Modern open-pit mines can extend to over 2,000 acres. The open pits can be 1,200 feet deep. The grinding up of rock and the application of cyanide sets off a chemical chain reaction that maintains its own momentum over time, maybe forever. There is land in England that was mined by the Romans with very simple tools. The runoff is still acidic after 2,000 years. A common chemical in rock is sulfur. Once exposed to water and oxygen, it becomes sulfuric acid, sometimes in concentrations as high as battery acid. And in turn, the sulfuric acid frees other often toxic chemicals from the rock, among them arsenic, cadmium, or even uranium. Water pollution is the most common damage caused by mining, and in the U.S. today we have 10,000 miles of streams polluted by mining. Of the 500,000 abandoned mines in the U.S., 52 are Superfund sites. Federal law does not require that mines clean up after themselves. In fact, mines have rights and privileges unlike any other industry, including coal and oil. All this is based on an arcane law, the 1872 Mining Law. It says in brief that any person, and that includes corporations, foreign or national, can stake a mining claim on public land. For example, the Barrick Gold Mine in Northern Nevada, a Canadian company, in 1994 paid $5,190 for the use of just over 1,000 acres. They removed $10 billion worth of gold and paid not a dime in royalties. The public is largely unaware of this obscene giveaway and of the scale and conditions of mining in the U.S. Mines are often hidden from view in the Nevada or Arizona desert, or in the middle of a forest in Washington or Oregon. The mining corporations also loom large over the small rural communities near which they operate. Sometimes the mine is seen as the only employer, even though half of the workers are experts from the outside, and progressive mechanization reduces the number of jobs that anyway don't last more than 8 or 10 years, the average life of a mine. But things are changing right now, and that is really the heart of this story. There are people in these small communities who dare stand up to the mining corporations and the often threatening mine supporters among their neighbors. We visited Larry Tuttle in his office in Portland and began by looking at pictures that he had taken on his 155-day walk across 5 western mining states. His goal had been to call attention to the urgently needed changes of the 1872 mining law. Larry showed us this amazing mix of slides of dead and ravaged mining landscapes, as well as the most pristine valleys and old-growth forests where mining was about to begin.
This is Butte, Montana. This is the famous Berkeley Pit. You can see where the pit for copper has been extended right into the city there. They actually relocated part of the city so they could make the pit. Very large, you can see it from space. It's the Anaconda Copper Pit. What's significant about this is taken about 20 years ago. You can see a little bit of water in the bottom of the pit. And I want to show you the next slides. This is about 5 years after that first one was taken. Let me show you where the water was 3 years ago. When it gets up to about where you see the crosshatching there, the kind of the horizontal steps there, there'll be 44 billion gallons of pH3 acid water there. And you throw a boot in there to eat the boot, and they don't have a solution to what to do with the water. They had some snow geese on this landed last year, and with obvious results. So about 300 snow geese perished. And that gets some public attention. Otherwise, it just kind of sits there on its own. And this is Grouse Creek Mine, just outside of Stanley, Idaho. It's about 400 acres. What's interesting about this mine is that after about 1 year of operations and this much land destruction, it is now shut down. It's shut down, according to the company, because the gold deposits that they anticipated there were not sufficient to justify the mine, that it wasn't as much as they thought. But probably the real reason is that despite their claims that this was going to be a state-of-the-art mine, a lot of bad things happened there. What they don't talk about here are all the landslides on the site, but basically they had to go back and build water treatment systems, and they never actually reopened after this. This is the Bear Track Mine. This is in, again, just in that same area in north central Idaho. This is a mine that has several feeder streams near it that feed into the Salmon River. We spent billions and billions of dollars. Sounds like Carl Sagan when I say that. Billions and billions of dollars. We spent billions of dollars to try to get the salmon back in the Salmon River. Feeder streams going into the Salmon River. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service denied a permit for this mine to operate, and the late Ron Brown, then Secretary of Commerce, met with FMC Corporation, a giant conglomerate out of Chicago, and they pulled the offending biological opinion, and the mine was allowed to proceed. So the mining companies have always had access to the highest levels of government, and they use it more than any other resource extraction folks I've ever seen. Much more aggressive in that respect than the forest products industry, for example.
What is the mining done for here?
This is also gold. And these are these large cyanide heap leach operations. I'm going to show you some additional photographs, but this is pretty typical of a size of a mine in the West. That's just the pit where they're digging the ore. One of the things that's obvious from these kinds of operations is that the pits fill up with water. And the difficulty with pits filling up with water is that you create acid when you have the interaction of broken up rock and water and oxygen creates sulfuric acid. Sulfuric acid in turn leaches out heavy metals. So you start this process with lots of water, lots of broken surfaces, then you end up with this toxic water solution. And I'll show you some evidence of that here in a little bit. These are actually the heap leach pads where they're starting to construct them, and you can see how they're starting to be built up there. That's where the cyanide that bonds with the gold will run into that kind of a trough, and then will run into those ponds up in the upper left-hand corner. Well, you can have several heap leach pads on a single site, but 80 or 100 acres for a pad is not unknown at all. And they'll be in anywhere up to about 80 feet tall. The research we've done would indicate that these kinds of mines use the amount of water and the amount of electric power that a city of about 7,500 would use on a daily basis. This is another operation in that same area. This is a molybdenum mine. That's used as an alloy for hardening steel. What I want to show this is the same mine. This is where they're storing the liquid tailings for this molybdenum mine behind this earthen dam, literally 14 or 15 miles from the middle fork of the Salmon River. I mean, that doesn't give me a lot of confidence that that's going to be around over the next 100 years to protect the area. In fact, it's not going to be. It's leaking badly, and they're trying to get the land patented, the public land transferred to their private ownership, so they don't have to comply with any of the federal clean water laws. This is a slide I always put in. I saw this when I was up in Idaho. A friend of mine took this photograph. It takes a lot of courage to stand up in some of those rural communities. It says, environmentalists, welcome to Salmon, Idaho. We haven't had a good hanging since 1954. That's fairly intimidating. It's more intimidating, to actually, I think, for these folks to be accosted in restaurants. A person I know up there working on mines works 4 12-hour shifts as a registered nurse at the local hospital. And when I was up there a couple of years ago, her supervisor wouldn't speak to her at all because she was opposing a mine literally in her backyard. It's pretty easy to, in comparison, to be an environmentalist in Portland and travel to rural areas. And this is the area up by Yellowstone that was proposed for a mine, a New World mine. This is a very big mine, and they've had all kinds of problems with soil stability. This is a cyanide vat leach, a little higher grade ore, and so they grind up the ore a little bit finer and put it in these big vats in order to recover more of it. This is an old growth reserve, yet they're proposing to put a mine in this area. And one of the things that's not talked about in mining is the fact that the miners can shut off public access to mining claims, and they do. And this is a Forest Service road that they've shut off. This is another thing that happens in mining claims. This is a patented mining site, meaning that it's been transferred to the private ownership of the miner, and they've just slicked that off. It's about 25 acres there, and we wouldn't allow any other kind of cutting like that on the public forest, but right in the middle of public forest, you can have this kind of a 25-acre, 100% clear cut on a steep slope. Yeah. This is the same drainage where you can't fish, but you can do this. We went ahead and mapped the frequency of the mining claims in and around the wilderness area, wild and scenic corridors. We found that over 6,000 mining claims in and around these protected areas, 500 mining claims inside of the wilderness area, all of which can be developed sometime in the future. This is kind of the attitude that pervades the management of minerals. And the little slide here says, we know what nature can do, and we're relatively certain that we can do it better than nature. I mean, there's a real engineering attitude in the agencies that doesn't matter what we do, no matter how destructive it is, we can fix it. The reality is that they've never been able to fix it, and there's no reason to believe that they can fix it.
That was a portion of Larry Tuttle's slideshow. As director of the Center for Environmental Equity, he travels a lot, and he campaigns for a change in mining practice and law.
The reality is that we need a mining law that makes sense for public lands. Talking about that in more of an organic sense and getting people committed to the idea that there needs to be some protections, and then saying that to do that we need to get rid of this 1872 mining law, seems to work best. Secondly, people just don't see mines very often, even small mines. They're in remote locations, they're even if they're close to population, they're usually in small cities. Small rural areas of the Northwest. And then lastly is just the tremendous financial and political clout of the mining companies. They've been able to keep the 18 Western states representing 36 senators in line politically for a very long time through campaign contributions and PR campaigns. They're better at it than anybody else I've ever seen in the extractive industries. And it's very hard to break a block of 36 votes in the U.S. Senate, because the other 64 senators tend to defer to it. And we've always gotten pretty good support out of the U.S. House of Representatives, but we've always, even when we've come close to like in the end of 1994 of having some chance for a change of in the mining law, falling short in the Senate because we just get brokered away. One of the myths is that the agencies permit mining. Under the present law, they don't issue a permit for mining. They simply allow mines to proceed under a preferred alternative. But I've read dozens of Forest Service documents and BLM documents, and they'll say right in those documents that we cannot say no to this mine because the 1872 law preempts us from it. You're talking about a situation in which the most powerful federal land management agency, the BLM and the Forest Service, cannot say no to a mine. The only way that we're going to put enough pressure on the mining companies to come to the table, and this includes the small miners, which are probably the most reluctant to come to the table, is to withdraw it from mineral entry, don't allow new mining claims until a new law is in place that has clean water standards, suitability standards, gets rid of patenting, and charges a royalty for the removal of any minerals that are taken from the public province. And if we can do that, then we have a start.
So that's a moratorium.
It's not a moratorium because the existing claims are still existing claims. And if there's an existing claim that they can prove there's a valuable mineral deposit, it would proceed. The charge can't be made that this eliminates strategic mining because it doesn't eliminate strategic mineral mining. It simply slows down the randomness, the chaos of allowing anybody, individual, corporation, partnership, foreign or domestic, to make a claim and have exclusive surface ownership, at least during the period of the claim, make a claim for mining. And so I just bringing some order to what I think is just an absolutely chaotic process at this point that undermines any good work that is being done by the federal land management agencies because they can't control any of this.
But even though you didn't raise the questions you're raising now, there was lobbying done against you by one particular company.
Newmont Mining Company, that was going to develop the first open pit mine here in Oregon. We took on Newmont with a voter initiative in 1994 to try to strengthen our own laws that would frankly make it, if they were going to develop it, they were going to have to develop under the best possible standards we could come up with. We forced them to spend almost $5 million to defeat the initiative, and although they won ultimately, they're not mining, so I think maybe we accomplished a lot of what we had set out to do, and we educated a lot of people in Oregon, and I think gave some inspiration to some of the other folks across the West as well, that to take on these mining companies, even if you lose at the ballot, that you really gain in the long run, because it's another way to elevate the issue that might otherwise be discussed. We want to go back and do pretty much what we're recommending at the federal level, do it at the state level, and that is develop organic standards for mining in Oregon. And the organic standard that I want to see is, again, no environmental degradation and restoration. See, we've talked about reclamation and mining for years. And reclamation means different things to different agencies, different states. The standard ought to be restoration. Public land ought to be able to use the same manner it was used prior to its being used for mining, or as close to it as possible. Reclamation is considered by many people to be more of a cosmetic approach. There's a wonderful writer, Montana historian by the name of K. Ross Toole, who has this chapter in a book called The Rape of the Great Plains, in which he calls reclamation the equivalent of putting lipstick on a corpse. And I think that's probably how we've treated mining in the West. We planted some non-indigenous grasses and went home and said that that's restoring the site. Then add to that sufficient bonding, and you might be able to protect the public's interest. You won't completely protect the public's interest because nothing can protect against the possibility of a tremendous spill or other disaster on site. In Oregon, in the law we passed in 91, we have very strict bonding limits, 100% restoration standard if necessary. The weakness in our bonding, however, is that the bonds are released too quickly after the termination of mining. Bonding ought to go on at least in some way in perpetuity. A friend of mine uses the example that if we can have perpetual care for cemeteries, we can certainly come up with a scheme to have perpetual care for mines that stop operations, and I think that's really what we have to look for.
As a former banker, how do you see manipulated commodity prices and mining propel each other?
I'm beginning to understand a little bit more about gold as a commodity than I ever have before, particularly, and that's what I'm most familiar with. Copper pretty much follows the same pattern as gold, and those are the two biggest kinds of mineral mining in the West right now. The largest use of gold, approximately 85% of gold, internationally is used for bullion or jewelry. Copper is used primarily for electronics. So they have slightly different paths when it comes to their commodity uses, but interestingly enough, their prices always seem to go up and down together, which indicates to me that there probably are international forces that are in control of of the commodity prices well beyond the borders of this country. In fact, we know that that's true, that what happens in Zurich, what happens in London, what happens in South Africa, what's beginning to happen in Southeast Asia, in Singapore, are really the places that control the prices for the commodities that come off of Western public lands. Jewelry prices neither go up nor go down with the change in gold price. What goes up or goes down is the incentive for mining companies to mine.
It's just so distressing, you know, that these two factors, the price of gold as a commodity and the development of new technologies, that these combined, you know, the cyanide leaching that makes cheap, low-grade ore all of a sudden profitable,
well,
that these two factors should condemn whole mountain ranges.
Well, one of the reasons is that mining companies do not want to see a restoration standard, things like filling the pit and so on, is that as technologies improve, they believe they can go back into those existing operations and carve out a little more of it using advanced technologies than they were the first time through.
That was my conversation with Larry Tuttle in Portland, Oregon, in 1997. At that time, he led the Center for Environmental Equity, an anti-mining organization. Larry Tuttle focused on the 1872 mining law as the major cause for the environmental destruction. Today, mining is a high-technology industry, but it is still governed by the mining law of 1872. As this program goes into distribution at the beginning of May 2024, an effort is underway to update the 1872 mining law with the Mining Regulatory Clarity Act of 2023. Representative Raul Grijalva is trying to stop the bill from moving ahead. He wrote, "Our more than 150-year-old mining law is already a disaster for our environment, communities, and tribes. It allows anyone to permanently lock up open public lands by placing four stakes in the ground and paying a laughably nominal fee. This giveaway would let companies do whatever mining-related activity they want on those public lands, including dumping their toxic waste." End of quote by Raul Grijalva. This recording is from the TUC Radio Archives and the series on mining in America. Every summer for 4 years in the 1990s, I went on a tour of mining sites in the western states. This was my visit to Montana and Oregon in 1997. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.